Small businesses are the cornerstones of our local communities, and small business owners are hardworking and passionate people who are chasing down their ambitions while there's a lot on the line. So, let Verizon champion your small business dreams. Whether you own a small business, are scaling one, or starting one from scratch, you need Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon, well, they've got you back. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/small business.
So why do you want to learn a new language?
I'll tell you why. Because ¿dónde está el baño? Can be a very important question at times. You know, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. Fast track your language acquisition with immersive lessons designed to teach you to pick up languages in a natural way. I love the fact that I can go from my laptop to my phone to pretty much anywhere and learn the language of my choice. Not to mention, I'm bringing my communication skills to new heights. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, StarTalk Radio listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/StarTalk. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/StarTalk today.
Coming up on StarTalk, Cosmic Queries, all about psilocybin, that hallucinogenic chemical found in mushrooms. I have no particular expertise in this, but we found someone who does, an expert on mushrooms. In the next episode of Star Talk, there is fungus among us.
Welcome to Star Talk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. Star Talk begins right now.
This is Star Talk. Neil deGrasse Tyson here, your personal astrophysicist. Today we're doing cosmic queries on none other than psilocybin. Oh my gosh.
Ooh.
Chuck.
Nice.
We haven't done one of these before.
The psilocybin, yeah. or the queries?
Oh. Queries on psilocybin.
I don't think I've done either, to be honest.
Yeah, that's the voice of Chuck Nice. Chuck, always good to have you, man.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, so psilocybin. Well, I have no expertise in this, and you may have user's expertise, but we need... This is...
Well, I'm intending to.
This
I'm
is a fundamentally academic show. Well, I certainly have no expertise in this subject, and I don't know if, Chuck, if you do?
I intend to.
Intend to, okay. So, but since we find the academics wherever they roam, where the expertise can be found, we've got it in Bryn Dettinger. Bryn, welcome to Star Talk.
Thank you very much, Neil and Chuck. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So you're a curator of mycology, not your ecology, mycology.
That's right.
At the Natural History Museum in Utah, and you're a principal investigator in the Dettinger Lab. What a coincidence there. What are the odds? And you're co-author of a just-published study at the publications of the National Academy of Sciences on the phylogenomics of psilocybin mushrooms.
Woo!
Whoa. So first, tell me what a mycologist is.
Sure. Man. Well, I'll start off by saying I'm gonna go with high.
Okay, Chuck.
Only sometimes.
What is a mycologist? What is a mycologist? High out of his mind. I'm sure. That's what? No, go ahead.
But a mycologist is somebody that studies fungi. Fungi is a whole kingdom of life relative to plants and animals. There's the whole fungus kingdom, and we know so much less about them than we do plants and animals. So mushrooms are just a part of all fungi. Many fungi are molds and yeasts, things that you might be more familiar with on your bread or your shower.
You know, when I wasn't looking, fungus became an entire branch of the tree of life, an entire kingdom.
And that was based on their mode of nutrition, so how they get their food, basically. So animals ingest things and fungi absorb things. And so that was emphasized when they removed them from plants.
I see.
Okay.
And another thing I learned just recently, like 5 years ago, that the common ancestor between mushrooms, fungus, and animals parted later than its common ancestor parted with green plants, which logically tells us that we and mushrooms are more genetically alike than either we or mushrooms are to green plants. I think I can say that. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely true. Yeah, so we share a common ancestor with fungi about 1.5 billion years ago. So that's quite a long time. Things have changed quite a bit. Obviously, we don't look...
But dude, I'm an astrophysicist.
Right, okay, yeah. So that's like a split second.
I was going to say, right. Drop in the proverbial bucket.
We got this. Okay, yeah, go on.
Yeah, so we look entirely different today. You know, the one track, the animals, they went through this internal digestion. And then the fungi, they're sort of the opposite. They're like our stomachs turned inside out. So they just live inside their food, squirt their enzymes out to their environment. They break stuff down and they reabsorb them. And that's why we look so different.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is a psilocybin?
Yeah. So this is a small molecule that some mushrooms produce. About 200 species of mushrooms around the world produce this compound. And nobody knows why they make it. But one thing that we do know is the way they make it is very highly regulated using a combination of like four genes that encode enzymes that convert the amino acid tryptophan to psilocybin just four steps. So why they do this is a matter of huge speculation. And of course, you and your viewers may already know that one of the activities of psilocybin when it's consumed is to produce altered states of consciousness in humans and other animals.
Yeah.
Mammals primarily or all animals, no matter what?
It hasn't been tested very widely, so we can't really say, but certainly all the mammals it's been tested on show behaviors that are consistent with an altered state of consciousness.
Okay, so there's some mushrooms that are just simply tasty. Others take you on mental trips, and others will kill you. So,
let's hope they never all get together. We are in big trouble if they do that.
Yeah, so this range of things it can do to us, is it just random that happens to be that way? I mean, there's a lot of species of fungus. For sure.
It's not entirely random, at least not in all cases. In the case of psilocybin, it might be what we call a happy accident, that it affects us that way. It might be that chemical has some other function in nature that we don't yet understand.
It traces back to 65 million years. That's awfully suspicious time frame in the history of life on Earth.
Are we to believe that the dinosaurs were high? That's why they didn't realize that they were about to get wiped out? Like, hey man, look at that thing in the sky. Oh man, that is really, really cool, man.
That's rad, man.
Look at that. Oh my God, look at the trail on it, man. The colors.
I mean, that's a little suspicious. What can you say about that?
I mean, I couldn't prove Chuck's hypothesis wrong, but...
Chuck is good at those kinds of hypotheses, by the way.
But I'll say two things. One is our ability to precisely pinpoint the origin of this in absolute time is pretty poor. So, you know, there's a huge range of possible dates that this originated. We call this a confidence interval. And so, the 65 million just happened to be sort of in the middle of that range. It was the mean, but it doesn't mean that that was precisely the time at which this molecule appeared. That said, an interesting consequence of the asteroid hitting Earth is that it created a nuclear winter, which blocked out sunlight, and sunlight is necessary for plants to grow. So there were no plants around, and therefore there was nothing that could eat plants, right? They were going to go extinct. Things that needed to eat plants, they're going to go extinct as well. But things that don't rely on live plants to feed and survive could thrive under those conditions. And that happens to be mushrooms that decompose dead organic material and things like slugs and snails that eat decomposing material. So those kinds of organisms, they actually did well after the asteroid impact.
Wow. You know, I hadn't put two and two together there to make that, draw that conclusion.
That makes perfect sense.
So there's is the great dying of organic matter, and this is a happy day for mushrooms and snails.
It does appear that mushrooms diversified very rapidly after the asteroid impact in many groups. So yeah, it may have been an opportunity for them.
The world is ours.
Just a couple more questions before we go to our Q&A. Chuck, you loaded up with the Patreon questions?
I do. I have them.
Okay. So how did we discover this chemical in them? Is it people grazing mushrooms until, I mean, they can't have been motivated to expect this.
Right.
So I guess, was it just random? And can we date that in the history of culture?
We don't know about prehistory and what kind of interactions our ancestors had with these mushrooms, because it's not recorded. But we do know that Mesoamericans.
Astronomically, history goes back to the Big Bang. So you mean history in the historian sense, where we actually have records of people, places, events, and things.
Our history.
Correct. Yeah, correct. Right. We also don't have a history of its use at the time of the Big Bang.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe it is the reason for the Big Bang.
Somebody thought it
Somebody took it and...
But in all seriousness, the first people that were documented to use it were Mesoamericans, and this was discovered when Europeans first arrived in Mesoamerica and wrote it down and then proceeded to ban its use, of course, because it was total sacrilege.
Right.
So knowledge was suppressed for hundreds of years until it was sort of rediscovered by an American ex-banker, Gordon Wasson, who traveled down to Mexico on these rivers that they were still being used for ritualistic ceremonies. And he documented it and published an article in Life magazine in 1957. And that is the source of modern understanding of the use of magic mushrooms. That's when he coins the term, in fact, magic mushrooms, 1957.
Wow.
Life magazine.
Yeah.
Who would have thought? And so I presume there are uses for this chemical besides just taking a head trip?
Yeah. So unfortunately, we haven't been able to explore that efficiently for the last 50 years, thanks to suppression of research by Richard Nixon. After he passed the Controlled Substances Act in 1971.
I don't want these people getting high.
Well, it was a form of social control. So he was concerned about the subculture subverting his political dominance. So he created all these challenges for people to explore freely in their world. But we don't need to get into politics.
What's the hippie? I think the hippies were considered countercultural to what the political agendas
exactly.
were.
Right.
Right. So, and if they're using psilocybin and they're not otherwise harming other people, and you make that illegal, then you can arrest hippies and get them out of your way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's basically the story behind marijuana too.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right. But today we're now having a resurgence of interest in its medical applications, and it's showing to have profound therapeutic value for a wide range of mental illnesses, from depression to PTSD, end of life care, all
kinds
of things.
You know, it's sad that we might have known this decades ago, and it's only coming out now. That's very unfortunate.
Yeah. That's a shame. And what are some of the benefits when you talk about depression, PTSD, which are slightly related? But then you say end of life. Is that the acceptance of end of life? Is that a pain management? Is what exactly is it for end of life?
Yeah, so I mean, I should say that I'm not a medical doctor, so I can just tell you what I've read.
You just sell to the doctors. You show up on their doorstep, open your trench coat. Right. Okay.
Not quite. Not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
And it is really about accepting your death in coming to terms with that.
Okay.
Yeah. So it doesn't provide any pain relief. Just a dissociation. But,
That was going to say that's a psychological pain reliever.
Yeah, in a way.
You know?
Yeah, in a way.
Yeah.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
When something happens to your car, you might say,
"No!" My car!
But what you really need to say is something that can actually help.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And just like that, State Farm is there to help you file your claim right on the State Farm mobile app. So, just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
I'm Kais from Bangladesh, and I support Star Talk on Patreon. This is Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
So, Chuck, we got a question. I think we've laid some good groundwork here.
Yeah.
To see where these questions come in.
Absolutely. Let's jump right into it. This is Patrick Weglinski. Patrick Weglinski from Salt Lake City, Utah. And he says...
Oh, another Utah person.
Another Utah person.
Utah, I'm worried now. You all gathering together or something? Mm-hmm. Planning something?
Well, this is the place. Okay. That's what Brigham Young said when he arrived.
Right. So this is the place.
I got it. And plus, Joseph Smith, to have had the visions he had...
Uh-huh. There might have been some mushrooms involved.
It just might have been. I'm just saying.
Okay, that's hilarious. He says, "Hello, Dr. Dettinger. I've been trying to get into mycology, and it can be very difficult. I find it much harder than growing plants. Why are mushrooms so difficult to grow, on purpose or by accident? Why do mushrooms need to have a super sterile condition in order to grow in an artificial environment, but can grow in the nastiest conditions wild?
That's right.
That's so true.
In fact, I saw a crack in the pavement and the mushroom was popping up through the crack in the pavement.
Absolutely.
So what's up with that?
Yes.
Yeah, so it turns out that unlike plants, they have to compete for resources that already exist. And there's a lot of things competing for the same resources. And so it's just through competition that you get a lot of contamination, but things that can grow better, faster.
All right, just to be clear, green plants do compete for sunlight.
Yes.
But there's an abundance of sunlight.
Right.
Whereas you're describing resources in the environment
yeah.
that it's one person gets it, the other doesn't.
Right. And when you're growing a plant, you're not going to grow it in the shade of another plant, right? You're going to manipulate its environment to make it thrive. But to do that with a fungus, the only way you can manipulate the environment is to make sure there's no other organisms present that can outcompete it. So you have to sterilize it. But why they occur in nature? Well, this is just a numbers game. So every mushroom, just for example, will produce maybe up to a trillion spores. Those trillion spores have to find a mate. They're not a full seed, so they haven't mated yet. But there's half a trillion possible individuals, reproductively mature individuals, that results from a
single
mushroom.
So you don't see all the failed mushrooms.
Exactly. Yeah. A much more concise way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a statistical bias.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
So if your guy, Chuck, had a trillion pots.
Right.
He'll get mushrooms in some of them.
He'll get some mushrooms with no problem.
Eventually. Right?
Or he could just keep a very dirty shower. All right. Well, that's cool. That's a great thing. That's a cool answer too. This is Stone Currier. And Stone says, hello, Dr. Tyson, Dr. Dettinger, and Lord Nice. This is Stone from Boston, Massachusetts. And yes, Chuck, that's my real name. Hey, man.
You know, I was going to say it sounded very, very Hollywood, but okay.
Yeah, exactly.
What's your name? Stone Currier.
Stone
I'm a leading
Currier.
Man. Yeah.
Exactly. Sounds like an anchor.
Yeah,
know?
I know.
Right. Today's top story, I'm Stone Currier. He says, I've heard that the largest living organism is one big circuitry of mushrooms. This is incredible and makes me wonder, is this one organism or just a way for multiple mushrooms to talk? Also, since they're talking, where do mushrooms lie on the consciousness scale? More than my tree, but less than my dog? And finally, is there any evolutionary benefit that some mushrooms give psychedelic hallucinations when eaten?
So, Bryn, this question better be true about mushrooms being the largest organism, because I wrote about that in a book I put out a couple of years ago. So,
well,
I'm listening.
Yeah, it is true, Neil. It is true. So, as far as we know, the largest individual organism by area is a fungus that grows in the Blue Mountains of Eastern Oregon. And it covers an area of about 3.5 square miles. Now, it may not be the largest in biomass. That may be topped by a cloned aspen called Pando in Utah. But it's certainly many times larger than a blue whale. And that's kind of surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah, but what makes it one organism? It's not just interconnected multiple organisms that happen to have... that managed to figure out how to
have a network.
One another. Yeah, network.
Yeah, so it appears, based on genetic evidence, that it is a single individual that's connected throughout this 3.5 square miles of forest through a network of hyphae, which we call the mycelium. That's the mass of hyphae that makes up an individual. And the mushrooms get produced on the edges of this mycelium whenever conditions are right there's some stimulus that causes it to make the mushrooms, but they're simply the reproductive structures. So the metabolically active organism, the what some people call the vegetative organism, this is just the mycelium in the soil.
Right. Which, by the way, is an excellent story propagator in the HBO series, The Last of Us, which is so cool because they're mushroom zombies.
Right, yeah. Right.
Plus, and they all talk to one another through a mycelial network.
So they, of course, in James Cameron's Avatar, he was highly inspired by the connectivity of multiple organimistic elements. So everybody had like a USB ponytail to connect into the plant that went into the animals.
Yeah, because the whole planet is connected by one network.
Yeah.
Which, wow, that'd be so great.
Yeah,
cool. What about the hallucinogenics and evolution? Is there any link between the two of them when it comes to eating mushrooms?
We don't know what link there is between evolution and these hallucinogenic chemicals, but if we take a lesson from plants, those chemicals are there to protect the plants from being eaten. And we think that that's probably the case with the mushrooms as well.
Oh,
so it's more of a defense than...
It's a defense,
No, wait.
Until we came along, and then it became a very poor defense.
I'm skeptical. Florins will prevent me from reaching into a flower bush, okay? There are things that'll prevent me. You know, a bee sting prevents me from getting closer to the bees. A chemical that takes time to have an effect on my brain, it's too late. I already ate the mushroom. So how can that be thought of as a defense?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Neil. And we think that it's not the chemical that's responsible for the defense, but a conversion of that chemical into something that would cause your stomach to burn. That's defense.
Okay. And I associate that bad feeling with having eaten the mushroom.
That would be immediate. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, that'd be immediate. Okay.
We can totally. Right.
And when human beings take psilocybin, do they experience this kind of burn, or is that part of the experience?
No.
Feel the burn.
No, because it functions at a much smaller scale than humans. So these chemicals didn't evolve in response to humans. We know that because they predate humans by 65.9 million years, at least.
Right.
So there you go. We know that. So they evolved in response to something else, and probably it's invertebrates. Those are the kinds of animals that cause a lot of damage to mushrooms, particularly land mollusks, slugs, and snails. So that's why we think that chemical evolved as a defense against slugs and snails.
But are insect invertebrates? Are they counted as invertebrates?
They are.
Yeah, but they are. Because they have an exoskeleton.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, but they still have a skeleton. I mean, I think of vertebrate or invertebrate. When I think of invertebrate, I think of like jellyfish. But that doesn't have an inner or outer skeleton. It seems to me the exoskeleton ought to count for something in the nomenclature. But
it does, but it doesn't have bones on the inside. It doesn't have a vertebra.
Right. It's a mush on the inside.
Total mush.
Yeah.
You step all on a water bug, you see all the mush pop out.
Or when you bite it with your chopsticks, right?
Yes.
I do that all the time. Yeah, that's how I eat. That's where I get my protein.
It's good for the planet.
This is from me. What is the difference between psilocybin and ayahuasca? And if you had a friend who owns a resort in Costa Rica who offered you the ability to come down and do ayahuasca, is that a safe thing to do?
I can't speak to the safety of ayahuasca, other than it's been used for probably thousands of years by indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin. But it is different. The chemistry is different. So one thing about ayahuasca is in order for it to be active, you have to mix two chemicals together. One chemical inhibits the enzyme in your stomach that would normally deactivate the other chemical. So this is called a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. And monoamine oxidases are enzymes that are there to protect us from getting poisoned when we eat things, primarily plants. So you're causing that enzyme to no longer function, which if there are other chemicals involved other than the one in ayahuasca that makes you high, that could be really dangerous. So sometimes people who have antidepressants, if you take an MAO inhibitor with that antidepressant, that can cause real problems. So I would recommend you seek some medical advice from a trusted practitioner before you engage in that.
Ayahuasca is also from mushrooms?
No, ayahuasca is from plants. So it's usually two plants, but often there's a mixture of other plants. But the two plants that are really important are a source of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is very closely related in structure to psilocybin, but pharmacologically has a slightly different action. And the other compound is just this MAO inhibitor, which can come in a variety of flavors.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So it's really, you have to deactivate a system in your body to allow the active ingredient to go to work. Otherwise, it just won't work.
Yeah. DMT is widespread in nature, particularly plants. It's in many, many different plants. But people do administer DMT intravenously, or more commonly, they vaporize it and inhale it, and that bypasses the digestive system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Gotcha. All right.
Keep it coming.
All right, here we go. This is Angus McNeil. And Angus says, hello, Neil, Bryn, and Chuck. I was wondering that since mushrooms have some medicinal purposes and you can eat most of them, would it make more sense to start farming mushrooms instead of traditional crops like wheat? Thanks, Angus, and I'm 13.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
so yeah, is there an environmental difference between harvesting mushrooms and harvesting green plants? And I'm not talking about the mushrooms you dig up and they charge $400 an ounce.
Yeah, yeah. That they have to enslave pigs. Doggone pig labor force, unfortunately.
So yeah, we're not talking about truffles.
Yeah.
But if mushrooms are nutritious, and of course they taste meaty, which is something no one ever accused kale of tasting. What? I would eat a bowl of mushrooms over a bowl of lettuce any day of the week.
Me too.
It's true. Yeah, I got to admit. Yeah. And nobody has a kale burger. But people have definitely had a portobello burger. So,
yeah.
Kale burger.
I mean,
that'd be a sad universe right there. If that's all me.
I'd say don't knock it till you try it. So cultivating mushroom, I would say it wouldn't be a replacement for traditional crop plants. And that's because the form of nutrition they provide is not complete. They're not very full of carbohydrates, for example, which our bodies
need. Well, neither are green plants.
Well, like corn, right? Corn or wheat.
Okay.
Yeah. Wheat.
Or potatoes.
The grains,
yeah.
All the grains. Yeah. Right, potatoes.
Grains, rice, and potatoes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So I suppose, you know, you could go on
not kale.
Not kale.
Not sorry, kale.
No kale. Carbohydrates in kale.
Definitely. What is in kale?
Yeah. Marketing. That's what's in kale. A bunch of marketing.
So, you know, they're a good source of proteins. And one important thing is that they have a complete, they're complete with their amino acids. So unlike vegetables, which are missing amino acids that animals need, fungi have all of the same amino acids. And that, of course, refers back to our shared ancestry from 1.5 billion years ago. That's why they have the same amino acids we do. So that's important.
Nice.
And they have some other vitamins, but you wouldn't be able to survive on mushrooms. A lot of the cell walls that they have are indigestible, like cell walls of plants. So they're not, they
right.
can subsist
on mushrooms.
So
you're just passing them.
Yeah.
You're passing them. You're not extracting anything
That's
from
right.
them. You know, but then they it's but the protein is
the
a protein good
is a great thing.
So yeah. I mean, so for vegetarians, mushrooms should be a really great addition to their diet for that reason.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you have to eat a lot of them because they're 90% water. And that's one of the other challenges
right.
with using mushrooms in place of meat or other foods.
Gotcha. Okay. Oh, that's a great question there for 13-year-old Angus McNeil. Way to go.
When you buy a new house, you might say,
shut the front door.
Winning.
No, seriously, shut the front door. We own this house now.
But you actually need to say,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
That's right. The local State Farm agent is there to help you choose the coverage you need.
Welcome to my crib. No one says that anymore, but I don't care.
So, just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Troy, who said that. That's all he says. He's Troy.
Okay.
He's like Cher.
Or Madonna.
Right. Yeah, or Madonna. You got to know who Troy. If you don't know who Troy is, then you're missing out, okay? Because I'm Troy, okay? So there you go. He says, hey, everybody, Dr. Tyson, Chuck, Bryn, Troy from Virginia here. Do you think plant life have any similarities that relate to the frameworks of the universe? I often feel like trees, mushrooms, and plant life have specific traits that model an attribute of the universe. What do you think that might be for mushrooms or for fungi? So is there any parallels that you can draw between the universe and fungi?
I think this might be a question for Neil.
I officially don't understand the question.
Well, I think what he's saying is when you look at the human brain and there are trillions of connections, and then you look at the universe and there's trillions of stars, and you know that there seems to be, there really is no correlation, but there seems to be some kind of correlation. You know, is there any correlation between plant life and fungi and the universe itself in either its structure, its composition, or anything that you might be able to draw as a parallel?
I'm going to say
no. Okay.
For the following reason. So what we learned when we looked out in the beyond Earth, we found planets orbiting the sun, eventually when we put the sun back in the middle of the known universe. So that was kind of cool. Okay. And then we looked into the atom and we found electrons orbiting a nucleus. We say, hey, that's just like the planets orbiting the sun. It's just like it, we said to ourselves. We thought to ourselves. So, but the more we looked at it, the less it resembled it. We even called the paths of the electrons orbitals, named after the planets orbiting the sun, orbitals. And orbital is a region of space where you would find the electron. Point is that different laws of physics apply for smaller gatherings of matter than for larger gatherings. Different laws of physics. So you can't sort of linearly go from one scale to another and then expect to have any clue what's happening in that other scale.
Gotcha. That's cool. You know, I okay. How about Andrew Gendro, who says, or Gendro, who says, hello, Dr. Tyson, Dr. Dettinger, and Chucknology. I don't know what that is, but he says, what is it chemically or biologically that makes rare prized mushrooms so delicious? And why are they so damned rare? Can't we just grow them like potatoes? We have mushrooms and we've got the dirt. What's the big holdup?
So
look at that.
I guess he's referring to truffles.
Truffles.
Yeah.
Yes.
So truffles are just a strategy that many mushrooms and non-mushrooms have taken to get their spores dispersed by animals. So this has evolved many times, hundreds of times actually. But the truffles that we typically eat as humans, they're in the genus tuber, which is a reference to the potato, as it turns out. And they have to be collected in the wild or sometimes grown in orchards, but it can take years for those to mature and be harvestable. And the reason is complex. So one is that they rely on the living roots of trees to grow. And we haven't yet been able to figure out how to mimic a live tree in a lab. So
they're basically parasitic to the tree.
You could look at it that way, but most people have viewed it as a mutualism. So they benefit the tree by giving the tree nutrients and water from the soil. And in exchange, the tree feeds the fungus with sugar that it makes through photosynthesis. And this has persisted.
Wow.
This allowed land to be colonized by plants 450 million years ago and has persisted to this day in 90% of all land plants. So
look,
it's kind of an amazing partnership between plants and fungi that has transformed the Earth's landscape and made it hospitable to animals like us.
Wow. So we kind of owe our existence to mushrooms. Wow, that is a just terribly fascinating little factoid. That's awesome. All right. This is Abram Pusada. And Abram says, "Hello, Dr. Tyson, Dr. Dettinger, Lord Nice. As we live in an exciting era of rapidly growing space industry, can you speak to the role of fungi in something like a Mars settlement, which aims to be self-sustaining? Could it play some part in making soil from regolith? If so, what else would it need to accomplish that? Also, assuming that at some time, some amount of soil is present on Mars, do you expect it will be a vital food source for the settlers?" So, are we taking mushrooms to space? Do they make a good space food?
That is true.
I think we will have to do that. Yes. They're really good at decomposing things. So if you think of your compost bin, if you have that one of those in your yard, that's essential for breaking down dead organic material and turning it into new forms of nutrients to grow plants. So if you imagine first trying to establish a colony in Mars, you're not going to be ordering up fertilizer off Amazon, right? You're going to have to make your own while you're there. And
Amazon delivers to Mars. Just keeps scrolling.
Oh, down, okay.
You see.
I missed that. So maybe fungi are obsolete to colonizing Mars. I don't know. But I also think, referring to our earlier question about their nutritive properties, this would be a good source of protein for early colonizers when there aren't large herds of cattle yet roaming Mars. So yeah, I think
cool,
they're essential.
Man.
And one other fun fact about fungi, there are a lot of fungi are resistant to high levels of radiation. And in fact, some fungi can actually convert radiation energy into their own metabolism. So there's good reason why fungi are going to be probably a critical component of establishing a settlement on Mars for humans.
That's so cool. So now, wait a minute. You say they're highly resistant to radiation.
Some, yeah.
Is that because they're 90% water, or is it because they have some properties that are whatever properties that might be? And then could we be able to take that and make a skin for a spaceship as a shield?
Yeah, I like where you're going with that. I'm not the one to help out with that, but somebody should definitely look into that. I don't know exactly why they are some... fungi are highly resistant to radiation. There's probably some biochemical basis to it, but I'm not familiar with it.
Interesting. Interesting. Oh, man, that'd be kind
of... Well, part of it could be just complexity. I mean, mushrooms are pretty simple, aren't they?
Well, simple in what sense? Because...
Well, structurally simple.
Yeah, okay. I mean,
if you have a lot of complex things going on, then any kind of pulse of radiation can do severe damage to what you are.
Yeah. But
if you're simple...
Yeah, I think...
You don't know any better.
I think you're right. The life form, the sort of vegetative phase is very simple. It hasn't changed in 400 and some odd million years, maybe even longer, because it's a very successful strategy. But when you get to the reproductive phases, those get to be quite complex. There's some very sophisticated mechanisms that would easily be disrupted through mutation. So I would say they're complex at a different scale. But yeah, you're right. Generally speaking, the... kind of the growth habit is pretty simple.
Right.
Okay. All right. This is Paul Patsova. And Paul Patsova from Slovakia says, "Hello, Dr. Tyson, Dr. Dettinger, Lord Nice. I would like to know, how do the interactions between fungi and the human microbiome influence health and disease? What are the possible beneficial roles of fungi in human health?" So are there any medicinal applications? We know about psilocybin, but that's more, you know, mental. Are there any medicinal applications for fungi?
There are some. There's a long history of use of some mushrooms in traditional Chinese medicine primarily. The jury's out, I would say, on just how, you know, useful they are in modern medicine. But potentially there's something there. In In reference to the microbiome, however, we do have fungi that live inside of us that are commensal. That is, they live there. They don't seem to have an impact on us, but probably they're doing something for us and we just haven't yet understood it fully. But we have yeasts that live in our guts. These can get out of control sometimes and cause conditions like Otto Brewery syndrome, where you have yeast.
Oh, that sounds delightful. Otto Brewery.
Yeah, so you're walking around drunk all the time because the yeasts are fermenting the food you're eating and turning it into alcohol, and then you're drunk. And this is a pretty rare thing, but it happens multiple times.
That is amazing. Dude, you want to go get a drink? Dude, I am drunk all the time. You keep your drink, sir. I am always drunk. Wow.
I mean, it's much wow. cheaper.
Yes, yeah. That's for sure. Yeah.
But there's emerging evidence that fungal infections have a wide range of impacts on human health, from Alzheimer's disease to cancer. And there's one fungus that's been implicated in causing the accelerated growth of pancreatic cancer. And there's a mechanism that's been established for this.
So it's not a fungus you've eaten. It's a fungus that's just somehow thriving inside
of you?
It's
a fungus that grows commensally on our skin. It's actually the cause of dandruff. It's called Malassezia. And sometimes people can get systemic infections of it. And when it gets into the pancreas, either causing or during cancerous growth of the pancreas, that's what seems to rapidly cause rapid growth of the cancerous cells of the pancreas.
Wow.
Jeez.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I know.
So we're just starting to understand the impact of fungi on human health.
So again, if this had been a branch of the academy at the turn of the century, for example, we would have been far more along than we are right now in the academic understanding of its uses and pitfalls.
Perhaps, but you know, these organisms are super hard to study. They're mostly microscopic. They're hard to get into culture and to look at and manipulate. And it's really only with recent advances in technology that we've had the tools to really interrogate in a real way some of these associations, like with the human microbiome. So I'm not sure we really would be that much farther ahead had there been more mycologists than ornithologists, but we'll never know.
Well, plus there's the tandem advance of other technologies that gives you the power to do the analysis that would not have existed decades
exactly,
ago.
Exactly, right.
Right, okay. But Chuck, time for like a couple more, like half more questions.
All right, actually, this is Boegert, Dieter, and just dovetailing on what you just said, he says, "Hi, I'm from Belgium. Humans have consumed psychedelic substances for thousands of years and many known cases of animals getting drunk and high. Do you think that making mind-altering substances illegal has stunted our growth and our wisdom? I'm worried about this. We're not allowed to get high, but we're allowed to consume ungodly amounts of advertisements every day. I'm worried that we'll stop thinking and stop being creative or revolutionary if we stay sober for long periods of time. Do you have any thoughts on this, please? This is a guy who really wants to get high."
Well, maybe he should relocate to Amsterdam. It's not that far away.
That's true. Now is are mushrooms or hallucinogenics, are they legal in the Netherlands? So,
mushrooms have been legal.
Wait, marijuana and hashishes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And mushrooms were for a while, and now they're no longer legal, but there's some loopholes. People have found that they can still sell hallucinogenic mushroom products that aren't mushrooms. So it is still possible to get them there. But
okay.
All right, yeah, cool. How do I answer that question, though? I think that altered states of consciousness, in whatever form they take, whatever the cause of them is important for humans to understand better their place in the world and to come up with new ideas that can result in innovation. And there have been some very high-profile cases of people that have attributed their mushroom trips or LSD trips to their success, like Steve Jobs, for example. So, you know, I wouldn't say that it's necessary for every individual, per se, but I do think it's a tool in our toolkit that we shouldn't just disregard out of hand.
Cool. I'm for it.
So it's an access point, an entry.
Yes.
An entryway.
Yes. It's one tool, okay. One access point. Yeah.
Cool. This is Teresa Anoski. And she says, "Hi, folks. I'm allergic to mushrooms. This seems to be an unusual allergy. What could it be about mushrooms that make me allergic?" It's Teresa from Long Beach, Mississippi.
Somebody else wants to get high and can't. Okay.
Yeah, well, I don't know what the cause of it would be. And I don't know if it's all mushrooms or just a mushroom. But they do, you know, they're complex organisms, cellularly, biochemically. Fungi are, you know, biochemical wizards, as one of my colleagues has put it. Because they compete in an environment where their only interaction is through chemicals. That's how they communicate. And so they make a lot of chemicals. And so there's a good chance that there's a chemical in there that somebody's going to react to, but could very well just be proteins or even the components of the cell walls, which are indigestible to us. They have cell walls made out of chitin, which is the same structure found in insect exoskeletons and crab shells. And then they have something that's very much like cellulose in plants, which is what we call fiber. You know, it could be just that as well.
Okay. I actually have one last question from Kevin the Sommelier, who is a friend of the show. And Kevin says, "Are there any new species of mushrooms popping up? And if there are..."
Popping up. I see what he did there.
Yeah. Did you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. "And if there are, is there a telltale sign of which ones that send you on a trip or kill you?"
Yes. There's a label on the side.
Oh, yeah. He said, "Or is it all trial and error? Also, in the spirit of mushrooms, Pinot Noir is a classic pairing for any mushroom dish, risotto being my favorite. I would select anything produced by Louis Latour from Burgundy."
See, we get free wine advice this way.
Yeah, that's why I read it, yeah.
but let me broaden the question there. There's, I think at our museum, at the American Museum of Natural History, there's a group, there are people who have gone through Central Park right there in the middle of Manhattan and have identified species of plants previously unidentified, all right? Which is what, when you get a new species, that's of course what that means. And I haven't read up close on that, whether these have evolved since we've had Manhattan or whether just no one looked hard enough. So there seems to be so many species of fungus. You must be discovering them every day.
Practically, yes. But it's so overwhelming. We just don't have the time because that's not necessarily valued, just describing new diversity today. We don't necessarily have the time to focus on doing that.
You hear that, Chuck? He's not into diversity. You heard that.
Yeah,
he's
I heard it, yeah. There's a big attack on DEI right now. Big attack on DEI.
Here's an example of it.
There you
mushroom
go.
Is trying to have identity.
Exactly.
Trying to get equity.
All right.
Trying to get inclusion.
Yeah.
And you say, "Oh, it's not worth it."
Yeah.
You do know I live in the state of Utah.
Oh, that was great. Okay.
Let me help you bail out of this. What I think what you're saying is that the behavior of mushrooms is more interesting and important than simply identifying every single one that's out there.
Right, right. And so, I'll throw some numbers out at you. 95% of fungal diversity has never been documented. 95%.
Wow.
So we've described about 150,000 species of fungi, but the estimates range from 2.2 to 12 million species that are out there.
Just fungus
of all kinds. And mushrooms represent a small portion, but a fairly diverse group of fungi.
They're the most visible.
They're the most visible, yeah. They're the most charismatic, if I'm allowed to call.
Yes, exactly. Hello, I'm a mushroom. How's it going? Do you come to this tree root office? Huh? Nice to see you.
Pick up lines in the mycelium.
I've been told I'm very charismatic. Got a lot of riz.
So the question was, are you identifying new species of fungus? So the answer is just plum yes, basically.
Yeah, we encounter them all the time. I would say every time I go out, I can't identify something that I've picked up, regardless of where I am, whether it's a well-documented place like parts of North America or Europe or somewhere where nobody's ever collected a fungus before. In many cases, there's something there that I don't recognize. Now, that doesn't always translate into a new species, but often it does, especially when you're outside of the well-documented areas.
If you're going to decide whether it's tasty, healthy, will send you on a brain trip or kill you, do you give it to mice first?
We should. So we use phylogenetic prediction to inform whether or not to try a new mushroom to eat. And I am not somebody that's I'm pretty risk averse when it comes to eating mushrooms, just because I don't like things that taste bad. I'm not worried about getting poisoned, but I have a delicate palate. So I'm pretty, you know, I use that rationale to say, if I'm in the jungle of Africa and I see something that looks like a European chanterelle, I'm going to give it a try because I know all chanterelles are edible, at least all the ones that we know about so far. And they're usually delicious. Whereas if I'm in the forest in Cameroon and I see a brown mushroom that stains blue when I scratch it, that's a hallmark of mushrooms that have psilocybin, but is not unique to them. And so I wouldn't take the risk, even if I really wanted to get high in the jungle, because there's a reasonable chance that that blue discoloration is a convergent trait, something that evolved independently. And so I could get very sick from that.
Oh,
okay.
Okay. All right.
Well, we're going to call it, next time we go mushroom hunting, we're calling
Please
you.
Please do.
Yes, exactly. Next time I'm out with my pig.
You can't use pigs because the pigs will dig the truffle up and eat it before you can get it.
Eat them.
Yeah, so you got to
Well, the idea
is train a dog.
Yeah, the idea is, the dog is the way to go. That's, I saw a great little documentary about, I believe they're in Italy, where there's a community of elderly Italian men and their dogs. And all they do is hunt truffles. That's all they do is hunt truffles. And it's a very, touching little documentary.
Yes, I saw that one.
More because of the relationship between the men and their dogs.
Right. Seems like a very peaceful life.
Yeah, yeah.
So have you seen, end on this then, have you seen the Last of Us, or what's the name of that show?
The Last of Us.
Can you comment on its authenticity? Sorry. Comment on its plausibility. Not its authenticity. Is it a clever use of fungus in storytelling versus bad use of fungus?
I mean, I think it's clever, but it's not plausible given our current understanding of those types of fungi and the hosts that they parasitize.
That's why it's called science fiction.
Right.
So what I mean, given what they've shown, did they have a mycelopic person on staff?
Not that I'm aware of, but they can call me up anytime.
Well, there you go. The gauntlet is thrown down.
No, because the better at sci-fi movies, they have someone on staff where at least you begin in an authentic place. And then your creativity takes the storytelling beyond that. And that reminds me of the Mark Twain quote, first get your facts straight, then distort them at your leisure. And that always makes for a stronger story, especially in a world where you have scientifically literate Comic-Coners who are going to talk about your movie if you don't get it right. You know, they'll tell you what's going down.
Right. Well,
so
yeah, I mean, HBO can offer me up a bottle of Latour Pinot Noir, and I'll be there in a minute.
You'll be there, truffle in hand. Okay,
there'll be Louis Latour.
Yes,
in Burgundy, there's a Chateau Latour in Bordeaux.
Right.
I don't know if they're related, but. It's been great to have you here, just to even know that I'm glad somebody's on top of the situation. And what is the title of this submission to the National Academy of Sciences? Or it's already published. What's the title
of it? Yeah, it's Phylogenomics of Psilocybe and Evolution of the Psilocybin Biosynthetic Gene Cluster.
Yeah, so you went for the short title.
So this is an important place for people to turn if they want to know what psilocybin is doing or what it's about or what its future might hold, right? I mean, this is reviews. This is a review paper, which is what the National Academy of Sciences is good at, which is the summation of years, sometimes decades of research of many to come up with some understanding of it. And just for those who don't remember or never knew, the National Academy of Sciences was founded by Abraham Lincoln in 1863, when he clearly had other things he needed to think about. He wanted an arm of science to exist, independent of government, but responsive to government when the government had questions and needs and needed and had to seek advice. So the publication series, I say, is one of the most important shelves of science you could ever assemble, the review papers of the National Academy of Sciences. So there it is. That's my shout out for objective truths. Rather than your favorite person on YouTube who tells you whether or not you should get vaccinated, you know, this is
not right. As they're teaching you how to make sourdough.
Oh, that was during COVID, right?
During COVID, yeah.
All right, Chuck, if you experiment with more mushrooms, give us a call. We'll invite Bryn back and we'll get a full analysis.
Oh, yeah. Well, now I have homework. That's great. That's fantastic. I love it. I'm up to the challenge.
All right. This has been Star Talk, Cosmic Queries, the everything you needed to know about psilocybin and more. I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson, your personal astrophysicist. As always, keep looking up.
When you buy a new house, you might say,
shut the front door.
Winning.
No, seriously, shut the front door. We own this house now.
But you actually need to say,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
That's right. The local State Farm agent is there to help you choose the coverage you need.
Welcome to my crib. No one says that anymore, but I don't care.
So just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.